listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The rapidly evolving realignment that appears to be developing in Asia continued to unfold Tuesday, as the U.S. and South Korea agreed to suspend the large-scale military exercises originally set for August following the recent summit between North Korea's Kim Jong-un and U.S. President Donald Trump. We begin with this report from RT's Samira Khan.
Well, this comes just a week after the historic summit that took place last week in Singapore, which Trump went back and forth on. There was some confusion whether or not it would actually take place. But just after the summit, Trump promised to cut back military exercises with South Korea, saying that the costs of war games are too high. But given their tense history, it's interesting to witness how dramatically Trump has shifted in terms of his attitude towards Kim in such a short period of time.
Best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury.
Rocket Man should have been handled a long time ago.
He's a very talented man. I also learned that he loves his country very much.
The White House also said that the drills would continue to remain a pause so long as the North Koreans continue to act in good faith. So it seems that there are no losers in this situation, especially considering that Trump is indeed keeping his word. Well, at least for now. So we'll just have to see what happens.
Meanwhile, Japan voiced concerns over the suspended war games as Press TV's Frank Smith reports from Seoul, South Korea.
U.S. President Donald Trump has said the United States agreed to suspend its joint military exercises with South Korea as long as North Korea negotiates sincerely on its denuclearization. After some confusion among U.S. allies, South Korea and Japan, the White House confirmed the arrangement after the drill's suspension was agreed with Seoul.
Those conversations are ongoing, and at this point, as long as the North Koreans continue to act in good faith, as we saw in Singapore, then we expect those things to be on pause at this point.
Japan in particular appears concerned the U.S. conceded too much in suspending the war games, hardly surprising given the Shinzo Abe government's desire to revise Tokyo's pacifist constitution.
It's our understanding that the U.S.-South Korean drills, like the U.S.-Japanese drills, or the U.S.-Japan-South Korean security and defense cooperation, are the important pillars of peace and stability in the region.
The suspension of the drills marks perhaps a cosmetic concession, which does not involve other significant potential non-aggression incentives, such as signing a peace treaty or withdrawing at least some of the 28,500 U.S. troops in South Korea.
Trump has not articulated what exactly U.S. will offer to North Korea in exchange for denuclearization. I think this is also one area that has been little explored in the media outlets, because the media outlets have been focusing on North Korea's denuclearization.
North Korea and South Korea continue developing cooperation on the heels of their leadership summit on April 27th. Monday, the two sides agreed to field a joint team for the Asian Games in Indonesia this August, and will Friday meet over restarting the reunions of families separated during the 1950-53 Korean War.
The suspension of joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises slated for August does serve to draw down the tension the Korean Peninsula experienced last year with the war of words between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Still, all sides agree it's only the beginning, both in terms of North Korea's denuclearization, but also concerning the security guarantees Washington has vowed to provide Pyongyang in return. Frank Smith, Press TV, Seoul.
Also Tuesday, Kim Jong-un arrived in Beijing for his third meeting with China's President Xi Jinping. Of late, Jessica Stone, reporting for China's Global TV Network, says Beijing is a key player in the ongoing processes sweeping the region.
Kim Jong-un's third trip to China since March comes as Beijing takes steps to strengthen its role as mediator between Pyongyang and Washington. China, of course, claims compelling security and economic security reasons to be heavily involved in the region. President Xi Jinping and his wife Peng Liyuan welcomed Kim Jong-un and his wife Ri Sol-ju to the Great Hall of the People. She and Kim also inspected an honor guard together. According to Chinese domestic media reports, Kim thanked Xi for his support, telling him he, quote, hopes to work with China and other concerned parties to promote and establish a solid, long-lasting peace on the Korean Peninsula. Kim was also expected to brief Xi on his talks with U.S. President Donald Trump in Singapore last week. Xi told Kim he hopes Pyongyang and Washington can carry out the results of their historic summit. Seoul welcomed the meeting.
The governments of South Korea and China share the same strategic goal of completely denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula. Also, our government hopes China will play a constructive role in resolving this problem. We hope Chairman Kim Jong-un's visit will contribute to that.
On Monday, Seoul and Washington announced they are suspending plans for their annual August military drills. Last week, President Trump appeared to surprise some in the region by announcing he was willing to suspend the exercises as long as Kim is, quote, engaging in good faith negotiations on the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. A spokesperson for the ROK Defense Ministry said regional defense remains a priority and Pyongyang will be expected to live up to its recent commitments.
Regarding South Korea-U.S. joint defense, both countries are preparing diligently without any trouble and will continue to do so. Also, regarding the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, we are expecting corresponding measures as we decided to suspend joint drills.
Last year, more than 17,000 Americans and more than 50,000 South Koreans participated in the August military drills. As for now, these are the only ones suspended, though that could be revisited in the future. Jessica Stone, CGTN, Washington.
Brian Becker is the executive director of the Answer Coalition and also the host of a daily radio program on Radio Sputnik based in Washington. He was in Singapore for the Korea-U.S. summit, and he spoke with CGTN's Elena Reyes about the situation on the Korean Peninsula.
What we're witnessing now in Korea, I think, is the initiative from North Korea, the initiative from South Korea, and the support from the People's Republic of China, that's what's really driven this new dynamic. That's what's created a new context. Donald Trump has joined this context. The decision by Washington to cancel these clearly provocative war games in August was a very, very positive step. But I think the DPRK, South Korea, and China are really actually driving the process.
And are you surprised that all of this has sort of come together? I mean, 6 months ago, this was a different conversation.
It was a different conversation. The bluster, the bluff, the threats, fire and fury, little rocket man, we're going to annihilate the DPRK, all of that kind of commentary, that bellicose rhetoric from Donald Trump and from others in the American administration. It's such a profound shift. It's almost a breathtaking change. But even back then, I personally felt that there was a great possibility. The DPRK had done what it thought it needed to do to guarantee its own security, a nuclear credible threat, a missile technology with a long-range capacity. And they said back in January 1st, 2018, we are ready now to reach out to the South. And the South reciprocated right away. The North and the South created this momentum. You can remember at the Olympic Games, Mike Pence there with his arms folded, looking all icy when the two Koreas came in together and there was so much optimism. Trump had to change that policy. The peace train was leaving the station and America wasn't on it.
What's going on behind the scenes now in Beijing? We understand that Kim Jong-un is briefing President Xi on the Singapore summit. What is the next step? What should we be looking for next?
Well, I think the next step has to be looked at from the point of view of what Trump and Kim Jong-un actually signed. The declaration and the order of the declaration is extremely important. Point number one was not denuclearization. Point number one was a new policy, a new relationship between the U.S. and the DPRK. Two, a permanent mechanism so that war would not come again to the Korean Peninsula. And then number three was denuclearization. Now, we know North Korea has taken unilateral steps, including a moratorium on its missile technology tests and nuclear tests, the blowing up of its own nuclear test site. What comes next now is a genuine reciprocation from the United States. The cancellation of the war games is a palpable next step. So that's the whole approach of DPRK and, I believe, China, step by step, synchronized, reciprocal. So I think we have a lot of momentum right now.
And are you encouraged by seeing Kim Jong-un traveling so much outside of the country in recent months? China three times, to Singapore, to the DMZ, who knows where else next?
Yeah, he's come to China three times. He's been invited to go to Moscow. Donald Trump has invited him, and he's accepted to come to the White House. As you mentioned, he was in Singapore last week at the summit. This shows that the DPRK has, in fact, already emerged from its isolated position. They are in a very much stronger position diplomatically. They're taking advantage of that to make palpable next step gains for the peace process. I think it's extremely positive.
Here in the U.S., the reaction to the developing situation in Korea seems stuck within the framework of partisan politics, or, more specifically, whether one loves or hates President Donald Trump. Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford discussed this and some of the history of U.S.-Korean relations with Professor Tony Montero.
First of all, on the side of Trump, who was both rational and irrational at the same time, Trump, I believe, crystallizes what has been inevitable for at least a decade and a half, if not more, that of the processes of imperial retreat, the attempt to be the single superpower, the military hegemon in the world, was bankrupting the U.S. And this is obviously clearly reflected in the collapse of the U.S. infrastructure, by which I include not just bridges and roads and buildings, but also the ruin of the American people through lack of health care, through lack of education, through lack of the possibility of a decent life. So the American people as a whole, including the African-American people, had become extremely disenchanted with the direction of the U.S. empire and of the U.S. ruling elite. And in a lot of ways, as we've discussed before, it is that discontent that led to the 2016 victory of Donald Trump. There's no other way to look at it. So there is that tendency, that process of imperial retreat, unacknowledged in the media, unacknowledged by most politicians who want us to believe that the United States is still the great superpower. But imperial retreat was inevitable, and a regroupment and a reorientation of the relationships of the United States, not just to the world in general, but really to its principal allies like the European Union. But that having been said, the brilliance of the leadership of North Korea was to seize the moment. Now, of course, that capacity to seize the moment required that the North Korean state arrive at a new level of military and technological capacity to defend the state, the Korean state, and hence the Korean nation, which they have. And that was spectacular. It was a spectacular political, technological, military feat to have developed the missiles and the hydrogen explosive capacities that they have, in spite of every attempt by the United States to intimidate them, to use cyber warfare, to undermine their tests and so on. They reached that level. And once that had been reached, then they were able to negotiate with, first of all, the Asian or Northeast Asian nations, in particular, China and South Korea, and to negotiate not from a position of strength, but from a position of equality. And thence, the fact that the president of South Korea was a mediator, a go-between to make possible what the leadership of North Korea proposed, a meeting with the president of the United States and the beginning of processes towards a detente, an end to the Korean War, the reunification in one another form of North and South Korea, and the withdrawal of U.S. military forces. I think, and this is a spectacular achievement, all of those things are pretty close to being realized. If you read the Singapore Declaration or document, it in effect says that North Korea and the United States want relationships of what used to be called peaceful coexistence. Trump said that he is for the end of these military exercises, which he said are and have been provocative, and ultimately the withdrawal of the 30,000 U.S. troops, and of course all of these weapon systems and aircraft carriers and so on from the waters around the Korean Peninsula and in South Korea. I would finally say that what we have seen is the emergence on the world scene of a new type of leadership coming out of North Korea, a small nation, and most of the nations of the world are relatively small in terms of population, a small nation, a united people, a committed leadership, were able to stand up for its right to self-determination in the face of threats and belligerency coming from the most powerful military empire in human history.
You described the South Korean president as a mediator, but I think maybe he was much more of an initiator. The two Korean leaders met certainly before the meeting with Trump and continued their dialogue even in the face of what seemed to be real U.S. opposition to them getting together. Mm-hmm. After all, that is the whole purpose, isn't it? To divide the Koreans.
Right. Yes. but I would still stick to my characterization. The principal agent of these processes is the North Korean leadership. If you recall, it was the North Korean government and Kim Jong-un that first floated the idea of North Korea being a part of the Olympics in South Korea. And from there, a number of other moves followed, including the fact that the sister and I think the president of North Korea attended the Olympics, and then other negotiations with the government of South Korea leading to, for the first time, a leader and a president of North Korea crossing the border into South Korea, and this great celebration of the possibility of reuniting the Korean Peninsula. I mean, this was so spectacular that 85% of the South Koreans look upon Kim Jong-un positively. So it's with that, and I agree with you, that the initiating of these processes began between the Koreans. And it is that which wisely Trump, if not his administration, realized that something new was happening, that inevitably the Korean people, North and South, would reject the whole scheme of U.S. military occupation and these exercises. I think that's what happened. And I think the North Korean leadership is principally the major factor in all of this.
And because this is in large part an agreement between Koreans, the development of these relationships, North and South, is something that the United States cannot effectively prohibit or inhibit.
That's right. And see, the other thing about it is that once the Koreans had reached what is in effect a detente and an agreement to end the Korean War and to come to some principles of unity, then the government in China responds to this, invites Kim Jong-un twice to Beijing for talks, which are friendly, which establish that if a detente is reached between the Koreans and then the United States, that the Chinese government would withdraw from the sanctions regime against North Korea. And then later, the foreign minister of Russia shows up in North Korea for talks with the leadership there, and then invites Kim Jong-un for a state visit to Russia. And then on top of that, the president of Syria, Assad, says that he intends to make a state visit to North Korea. I mean, what we are seeing is an unleashing of processes of peace and self-determination, the likes of which we have not seen in over 25 years since the collapse of the Soviet Union. And I would predict that all roads from Africa and Asia and maybe even Europe now lead, and also South America, now lead to North Korea. I think the leadership there will be a model for many nations in the world and demonstrates how both to pursue socialist construction, to consolidate state power, and at the same time to develop the technology necessary to defend the state.
Russia and China did participate in sanctions against North Korea. Russia and China have participated in sanctions against Iran, even though Iran is now or will soon be a member of the Shanghai Cooperation Agreement. And even though these sanctioning parties have been sanctioning Russia, are we going to soon see an end to Russia and China's cooperation with these sanctioning regimes?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think in terms of the sanctioning regimes against Iran and North Korea, they're done. And the United States, if it continues sanctions, or new sanctions, as Trump is talking about against Iran, they will be isolated. And certainly the world, including the Trump administration, has stated that they are prepared to withdraw from the sanctions regime against North Korea. But I think it raises still some questions about how Russia and especially China operated over the last 35 years on the world stage. It was like they were allowed to come into the World Trade Organization, which is this global finance capital run organization with rules of operation that favor multinational corporations and banks and so on. Once they were in there, then they began to play by the rules of the West, including in the UN Security Council, to position themselves against nations who develop weapons merely to defend themselves. And so the Russians and the Chinese, and especially the Chinese, were playing this 19th century and 20th century great power game, that what was in the interest of China would be pursued. There was no sense of international solidarity. That is, of course, not new in China. Even after the revolution, they were profoundly nationalistic and Chinese-centric. And so they remain so. Hopefully there might be some changes. The Russians, of course, sanctions against North Korea for its developing nuclear weapons, but at the same time, inviting Netanyahu as a state visitor on the National Day celebrating the end of World War II. Friendship with Israel, but in this period that we're talking about, hostility in favor of Western interests against North Korea and Iran. I think that might be ending. It does not solve all the problems because the leaderships in Russia and China are divided on any number of issues, including their role in the world, how, if at all, they will fight for world peace. But more than that, will China eventually return to the path of socialist construction? And will Russia adopt policies that do not favor oligarchs and rich people and billionaires in Russia, but are more predisposed to a working class, even a social democratic policy that will uplift the living standards of their own people?
Certainly half the Republicans don't sincerely support this peace initiative, and the Democrats are outright hostile. Is there only Trump standing behind this on the U.S. scene?
No. Again, I go back to the inevitability of imperialist retreat. U.S. imperialism had overreached and was bankrupting itself and the nation to support its military empire. Retreat was inevitable. They weren't going to announce it and say, oh, we're in imperial retreat. But if you look at much that's going on in the world, one sees this retreat. Now, TPP, or the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which comes out of the Obama administration, to me represented in a very ironic way the sense that the military empire had to retreat and take second or backseat to new economic relationships in East Asia. But, you know, again, and here we're just speculating, I think we're looking at what was inevitable for Republicans and Democrats. The conflict was over how to do it, when to do it, and so on. Of course, you get hardliners that say we never can retreat. And then you get people who are hardliners in public, but in private recognize that the United States' role in the world had to change, or else both parties would face on a grander scale what happened in 2016, which again was the result of a legitimation crisis that masses of people have turned against the political establishment, literally the regime itself. And without a new kind of, you could call it a new deal, a social democratic set of policies to do something for the increasingly impoverished American population. And what I saw as very important in 2016, and it's not just a single line, it's contradictory, is that a great part of, if not the majority, of white Americans are distancing themselves from the neoliberal regime, which, and the policies which have impoverished them.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. After 3 years of conflict, it has been estimated that out of a population of 27.4 million, 22.2 million people in Yemen are in need of humanitarian assistance. 4.5 million children and women are suffering malnutrition, while 2.9 million people are internally displaced. This is a humanitarian catastrophe by any measure. So why are the U.S. and U.K. so committed to the Saudi-UAE war on Yemen? Cross-talking the tragedy known as Yemen, I'm joined by my guest, Mohamed Mirandi in Tehran. He's a professor at the University of Tehran. In London, we have Charles Shoebridge. He is a security analyst and a former UK Army and counterterrorism intelligence officer. And in Brighton, we cross to Catherine Shakdam. She is a senior analyst with Al Bayan Center. All right, cross-talk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let me go to Charles first. This war has been going on for 3 years. I gave some of the stats. I encourage our viewers to go to Doctors Without Frontiers and look at their site on Yemen. Much more detailed, much more gruesome, I would even say. What is the U.K.-U.S. interest in this war against the country, the poorest country in the Middle East? What is the thinking behind British foreign policy supporting Saudi Arabia and the Emirates against Yemen?
I suspect on the one hand that you've got UK and the US seeing that to some degree, and we can come on to that later on, their national interests are aligned with those of Saudi Arabia, particularly against Iran, of course, in Yemen as elsewhere. And again, you have to question, and hopefully later in the program we will do that in more detail, as to why the UK and US always seem to see their interests as being in conflict with Iran in most instances. But also there's got to be an aspect of this which is based on commercial interests. Of course, Britain and America supply vast amounts of weaponry and other equipment to Saudi Arabia. The relationship with Saudi Arabia, particularly, it's not just Saudi Arabia involved here as well, of course, other Gulf states as well, all of which have very lucrative commercial contacts with Britain and the United States and indeed France. And there has been certainly over the last few years a tendency for, particularly in the United Kingdom, that anything that Saudi Arabia supports, pretty much Britain and America are going to support also. And we have to remember just really how important this relationship, particularly with Saudi Arabia, is. If we think about Trump, we think about other government ministers in the United States and the United Kingdom, their first port of call when they've been put into office isn't their allies in Europe or the States often. It's usually going off to see two players, both of whom are vitally important to British and particularly American interests. One of those is Israel, the other one always Saudi Arabia. And so really, I think this war is becoming increasingly an embarrassment, not just war, but the blockade and everything else that goes with it is becoming an embarrassment to Western leaders, as invariably parts of it creep into media coverage because there's been a near blackout as we know the last 3 years.
Creep.
But also they will continue to support it.
Catherine, let me go to you in Brighton. Okay, so we've got a little bit of the background, the reason why, if we can use that term, for the British and the Americans. So what does victory mean in Yemen for the Saudis and in the UAE? Genocide? I mean, what do they hope to, what is the end goal here? Go ahead, Catherine.
But the end goal was basically the situation that would we have prior to 2011, when the people decided to rise up against the then, you know, regime, whereas Saudi Arabia was in control of Yemen and Yemen's political future as well as economical future. And I think that this is what they're trying to do. They're trying to revert back to, you know, the situation that we had, you know, pre-2011. But it's not going to happen, because people have learned that they have a right to political self-determination. Mm-hmm. And they understand today, most, you know, the majority of Yemeni understand that Saudi Arabia is not there to promote a greater Yemen, or even to promote a greater future for Yemen, but rather, you know, to have yet another country, a clan state, that will remain forever tied up to Yemen. If I may, just very quickly, when we talk about, you know, British and the US siding with Saudi Arabia because of the fear and animosity they have towards Iran, we need to be very careful here to understand that Yemen is a proxy only in the eyes of Britain and the US, because there is no Iranian influence. But Yemen represents geographically an advantage in that it's sitting on very important waterways, militarily and, of course, because of the oil route, which is why Britain and the US are interested in Yemen in the first place. It has really nothing to do with the fact that Iran has an eye on Yemen, but rather because of the geography and where Yemen is situated in relation to Iran and the rest of the Gulf countries. And I think it's an important point, because we need to stop this narrative that Iran, you know, has an interest in trying to promote unrest in Yemen. That's not the case. If anything, Iran needs stability in the region to be able to itself, stabilize its own borders and everything else that goes with it.
I think that, Catherine, I'm really glad you brought that up, because there is a self-determination issue in Yemen that is never brought up in the mainstream media. And Charles already brought up the issue that is always mentioned. I'm going to go to Mohammed now in Tehran. It's all Iran's fault, as usual. I mean, pick the day of the week. It's Russia's fault or Iran's fault here. Now, I'm willing to agree that Iran may have some kind of involvement on some level now, but not in 2011. That was how it was sold, the Saudi intervention in the first place here. But it's always Iran's fault. It's a proxy war. It's far more than a proxy war, as Catherine has pointed out. Go ahead, Mohammed, in Tehran.
Well, this is one of the excuses that Western countries and the Western media use in order to justify the crimes being committed by their governments. The Canadian government, the American, British, and French governments are involved in crimes against humanity. And they are just as guilty as Mohammed bin Salman and the Saudi regime and all this. Without them, he couldn't be carrying out these crimes. The Americans are providing all sorts of logistical support, so they need to justify it somehow. Obviously, for anyone who knows anything about what's going on, the Yemenis do not have the ability to have any meaningful contact with Iran. There's no way that the Iranians can help them in a meaningful way, because they are completely surrounded. The Americans and the Saudis and others have laid siege on the country. They're preventing food from getting in. They're enforcing starvation. They've been doing this for years now. And the Western media, they call it a proxy war, or they try to somehow blame the victims, like in Gaza, in order to, again, justify their policies. But it's obvious that this country is surrounded. The overwhelming majority of the population is living in the areas controlled by the Ansarullah and their allies, the popular committees and so on. After all these years, after over 3.5 years, with all the foreign support, American support, European support, mercenaries from different countries, Blackwater, and an American and French official military presence on the ground, Sudanese mercenaries. After all, you know, with all the money that the Saudis and the Emiratis are spending, if they cannot capture the capital of the country, that shows that it is the will of the people of Yemen that prevents them from doing so. That shows that the resistance against the Saudis and the Americans is a legitimate and popular resistance. But that's something that they don't want to see, because that makes CNN, that makes the New York Times, The Guardian, the BBC, all of them run against their own government. If they point these out, that humiliates their own government position.
Charles, I have noticed that what scant coverage there is on the cable stations, the Iran card is almost always played first. Okay, and there isn't a willingness to admit that serious war crimes are being committed. And I'd like to point out that the Houthis also have been accused of that. In all fairness, but this is a very tragic conflict. What is the end game here? Because I mean, just reading the stats, I mean, this is a country, a humanitarian situation that is winding down winding out of control in a very serious way. I mean, cholera, I mean, something that is virtually wiped out and the world has come back in a vengeance there. And there seems to be no outcry whatsoever from the media. I mean, it makes them culpable. Go ahead, Charles.
Or if there is outcry, as you've already kind of hinted at, it's at a humanitarian situation that seems to have risen out of nothing, that this is a famine, that there are hundreds of thousands of children not in education, that there is, as you say, for the second year running, now the danger of a cholera epidemic breaking out, as if this has got nothing to do with the fact that this war has been visited upon this people by Saudi Arabia and its allies. But particularly, of course, what's missing from the Western media coverage is that this war, this assault on this country, as you point out, one of the poorest countries on earth and facing terrible predicament for its people, that this assault on this country is enabled totally by Britain, America and France, particularly Britain and America, in supplying the weapons that are being used against the Yemeni people. And of course, study after study from independent organizations, from monitoring groups, human rights groups, as well as the UN itself, have shown repeatedly that there has been almost no care taken to prevent civilian casualties. We're talking about the humanitarian situation that is largely been caused by the blockade that is in place, that is preventing medicines and foods arriving. As we speak, even fighting going on, of course, the assault has been launched on the major Houthi-held port by the Saudis and the Emiratis, again with British and American and French not only material cover by providing the materials, the logistical support, the intelligence, the refueling and arming capabilities, but the weapons themselves, but also diplomatic and propaganda cover. For example, it was Britain, France and America that blocked the Swedish initiative a few days ago to actually call a ceasefire. And that was actually virtually absent from UK and US media coverage. And one other aspect I would just quickly mention, what Catherine mentioned, and to support what she said. It's interesting about the Iran angle, as you mentioned, always being brought up. But in 3 years, no actual hard evidence has been shown whatsoever, even by those that claim that Iran is backing the Houthis, to prove that
Jump in here, and we have to remember that in December of last year, the Pentagon admitted it had troops on the ground. We're going to go to a short break, and after a short break, that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Yemen. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let me go back to Catherine on Skype in Brighton. Well, as we've already pointed out in this program, and you put it quite definitively in the first part of the program, the people of Yemen do not want to be occupied. They've proven over the last 3 years to be quite resistant to that, even though the casualties are high in every single way. There has never been any solid documentation that Iran is helping militarily or in any kind of meaningful material way. So what is facing the Saudis and the UAE in the Emirates? I mean, it doesn't. Are they going to have a land invasion and occupy it? I mean, the people of Yemen have shown themselves to be quite resilient to the onslaught that they've experienced over the last 3.5 years. Go ahead, Catherine.
Well, yes. I mean, historically, Yemen was never invaded. Even the Ottoman Empire actually, gave up and allowed Yemen to have a great degree of autonomy. And it really goes to show that, the Saudi are not really good at brushing up on their history, bearing in mind that Yemen is actually their direct neighbor. Now, when it comes to, a military victory, I don't think it's going to happen because if the south of Yemen might actually give up and actually open open itself to the UAE or Saudi Arabia, I very much doubt that that the North will give up because, you know, they are very different people altogether. And for very obvious reason, they understand that any occupation by Saudi Arabia would mean an entire genocide for them because Saudi Arabia is very sectarian in its approach and has made sure that, you know, the Houthi, Ansar Allah, the resistance movement in general and Northern Yemen globally has been labeled under this, you know, this Shia title and therefore should be obliterated. We tend to forget this. You know, the Saudi are not just out there to gain victory. What they're trying to do is annihilate an entire people because of their religious standing, their religious belief and their tradition. And, you know, forget a little bit about the civilian casualty and understand that they're not collateral damage. You know, the Saudi have architected this war to inflict maximum damage on civilians because he wants the people to rise up against the resistance movement, not understanding that the resistance movement in itself is made out of the people. The legitimacy that Ansar Allah has is given by the people of Yemen. It's not being created out of thin air. And therefore, a victory for the Saudi is, by definition, impossible. The people will not allow it. But in the meantime, we're facing a catastrophe of biblical proportion. Because Northern Yemen is being decimated for only one reason, is that these people decided to be free in their own land, in their own sovereignty. So the real question is, are we actually willing in Western countries to defend a nation such as Saudi Arabia and actually give up and forfeit our own rights to our own sovereignty and own democracy? Because this is what we're doing by allowing a country to unlawfully declare war on another in Yemen.
Right. Exactly. Let me go back to Mohammed in Tehran. I mean, we see some kind of peace overture process with North Korea about nuclear weapons, and then we kind of go on the other side of the world and we have Iran. And considering the cast of characters that surround President Trump, I'm not hopeful at all on what's going to happen when it comes to Iran. I have a distinct worry that they're going to use this humanitarian crisis, given the way the media works. Is they going to say this is Iran's fault because of Iran's involvement? And that's just another box that is checked in this agenda that looking at regime change in Iran, punishing Iran, more sanctions, et cetera, et cetera. And this is when they'll pull out the pictures. This is when they're going to have the crying mothers and the skinny babies. That's when they're going to start showing those pictures. They have them all saved up and archived, and that's when they're going to use it. That's my supposition, okay? Go ahead, Mohammed.
I think it's quite obvious that what is different in this part of the world is the Saudi-Israeli alliance and their relationship with the White House and the United States political regime in general. Recently, we saw another airstrike on Bu Kamal in the east of Syria, where either the Americans or the Israelis bombed Iraqi and Syrian forces that were fighting ISIS. But this is something that the Western media won't touch. Why? Because it's in the interest of the Israeli regime, it's in the interest of the Americans to keep Syria unstable and to strengthen Israel. That is the criteria through which everything is judged. And in the case of Yemen, we see the exact same thing. Because Yemen is opposed to Saudi Arabia, the people of Yemen are opposed to Saudi Arabia, they don't want to legitimize this resistance. So they have to find a scapegoat. And that scapegoat is, of course, Iran. Whether it's in Gaza, whether it's in Syria, whether it's in Iraq, everything is Iran. And I think it's very racist, the way in which Western countries the Western media ignore what's happening in Yemen, which is the greatest catastrophe so far in this century. But on the other hand, I think what's important is that the Saudis are losing the war. Despite all the propaganda in Al-Hudaydah, the Saudis have been unable to capture the city. They've been unable to capture the airport. They face serious casualties. We have, according to the resistance in Yemen, the Americans have a command post in Bureiba and Moha in support of the attacks. We know, for example, that Al-Qaeda in Yemen, as the head of Al-Qaeda said last year, that they are fighting alongside the Saudi and UAE-backed forces, which is not strange because that's exactly what happened in Libya. Al-Qaeda was used to overthrow Gaddafi. And look at Libya today, just the fighting right now that's been taking place over the last few days, or what we saw in Syria. And of course, in Syria, the Western media likes to say that President Assad has killed hundreds of thousands of its own people. But in reality, it was Obama and his allies that are responsible for these deaths. And in Yemen, if you notice, they always say, for 3.5 years now, they've been saying 10,000 people have died. And where in reality, hundreds of thousands of people have died. But they try to downplay the casualties in Yemen, try to hide them, even though hundreds of thousands of people have died from cholera, from starvation and other sicknesses, preventable sicknesses. And whereas in Iraq and Syria, they were trying to inflate it, despite the fact that they were in reality the side that was responsible more than anyone else.
Okay, let me go to Charles in London. We ought to point out also that a number of international aid groups are leaving Yemen because of the humanitarian crisis, being there to help, but it's getting to such a critical point that they can't even protect their own people. I want to stay with Charles in London. I mean, I looked at how the Pentagon has reacted to all this. They say that they are solely targeting al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula. Does that cut any... Does that make any sense to you? I mean, that's what they say, but it seems to me that if they're giving logistical support, then I guess all these al-Qaeda people are in wedding processions all the time, okay? I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me at all. Go ahead, Charles.
Yeah, America and Britain, as often, they're playing a double game. They will say one thing in public, and in private, they're doing something else. So, for example, they will say that they urge restraint on Israel, that they urge restraint on Saudi Arabia. And then behind the scenes, it's clear they're saying, that's all you're going to hear from us. Where's the next check for the next weapons load that you're going to use to carry out these humanitarian atrocities? In Yemen, it's absolutely clear that one of the main reasons why Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is still a problem for the West is because of the instability in that country. In the same way that ISIS came out of the instability created by the West, or at least largely fostered by the West, in Iraq and Syria, and now, of course, also, as was pointed out, in Libya. And so, and then, of course, notice how in Syria, the existence of ISIS on the ground, even though that is waning largely as a result of being crushed by forces such as Hezbollah, the Iranian militia, Assad and the Russian Air Force and so on, that the presence of ISIS is then used by the United States and Britain as a justification for having troops and a presence on the ground. And that's there's probably some element of that in why the Americans are still active in Yemen. But the main reason is to support the Saudi onslaught. The Saudis have proved again and again that regardless of the massive amount of military capability they have, that in terms of actually putting that to use, they are not actually that competent. They've shown that repeatedly, and therefore they are largely reliant on Western logistical intelligence and other support. But let's put something as well, throw something into the mix here. For example, within the last 3 years, Britain's arms exports to Saudi Arabia, they equate to something like $10 billion. Half of all Britain's arms exports go to one country, Saudi Arabia. And that's on top of the massive Saudi and incidentally also Qatari influence that these countries have on the City of London in terms of ownership of stocks and shares, companies, and also real estate. And let's not forget as well the massive flotation that's coming up of the a large part of the Saudi sovereign wealth fund, the oil fund, that is going to come up in the next few months, for which London is and New York are absolutely vying to achieve the flotation on their markets. And so to support Saudi Arabia, for Britain, or at least the elites running Britain and America, as well, when you look at political donations to the ruling elites that are running these countries, the role of Saudi Arabia, like Israel, is absolutely vital. And the sad thing is that they put on one side the massive lucrative gains that are to be had from continuing this relationship, this toxic relationship with a country like Saudi Arabia. On the other side is the suffering and the deaths of and the creation of a humanitarian catastrophe, which is largely not being reported in the West and certainly isn't being reported as anything in which Britain and America are complicit.
Okay. The latter part of what you said, Charles, it's just shameful. It's just utterly shameful. And having the media cover because of stock prices. Oh, my goodness. Catherine, there are reports that the Pentagon is hesitating a little bit with this last major report, Hodeida, because they know if they if they allow the Emirates to capture it and shut it down, then the humanitarian crisis just gets accelerated. Somebody in the Pentagon is a little worried about this. That's just reports I read. Last 40 seconds of the program go to you, Catherine. Go ahead.
I don't know if they're really worried about the humanitarian catastrophe. I think they're actually worried that they're going to lose, you know, this battle for the support of Hodeidah, because I don't think that Yemen resistance movement will allow it to fall, and they will throw everything that they've got against it. So I think it's more to do with, you know, having to lose very publicly a very geostrategic, seaport in northern Yemen, rather than really caring for humanitarian crisis, because this crisis has gone on for 3 years and millions of people have already suffered and are and continue to suffer. So I don't think that Washington is very preoccupied, you know, by civilian suffering and casualties. I think it has more to do with losing very publicly a very important battle for Yemen, because, you know, if Hodeidah doesn't fall, the Saudi have lost more than just the war. They have lost their standing in the region.
Okay, Catherine, I have to jump in here. We've run out of time. Many thanks to my guests in London, Brighton, and in Tehran. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk Rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.